has many meanings. One to replenish, one to correct, one to lift up. We hope to employ all three meanings at this retreat. Let's treat ourselves, replenish ourselves with silence, replenish ourselves with inner composure, with calmness. When we are home, we say we don't have enough time to sit down and calm our mind. Come to a retreat, there is the opportunity to gorge yourself. When you gorge yourself, you gotta kill yourself, so you treat your mind. Try and treat you of your doubts and fears about yourself. And when you are healed of your fears and doubts about who you are, then you have to emerge, you have to lift yourself. So, that's the other part of the treat. Raise your consciousness. These techniques are very simple. The purpose of making it simple is that we want to re-evaluate our behavior. We want to make the body over from a rigid condition into a flexible, pliable condition like a child, so that the biorhythms, the body energies, can flow easily through without interruption from the thought blocks. Bring on the result of health. Spirituality is health. The highest experience of health is bliss, ecstasy. Saints are only people who spend their entire life refining themselves to enjoy ecstasy for eternity. They live a very simple way. But there are two types of saints. Those who withdraw from the world to find themselves. They are called renunciates. And those who withdraw from the world to find themselves to go back into the world, they are householders. Between the two, the householder has a greater challenge. Because the confrontations are faster, the responsibilities are greater, and the disciplines are tougher. Greater the obstacle, greater the person. No obstacle, you got a weak person. And most of the great masters have all worked out and lived the household life. In today's environment, householder life is the greatest challenge. But we do need periods to withdraw, to feast in the spiritual consciousness, periods to heal ourselves from our fears and doubts, our sense of insecurity, and periods to lift ourselves out from the conflict of the environment. That is what a retreat really is. Ashrams are merely spiritual hospitals. I call it spiritual garage. You come and get a tune-up. Overhaul your spirit. God is bliss. In the highest essence of the soul. He is not light. He is sound. The audible life current. He is not a person. He is a principle. We use the word he as if we're thinking of a man. But we're not thinking of a man. We're thinking of a positive pole in a matrix of activity. So the Orientals like to symbolize their concepts by art. They would draw the concept of he as male, the concept of she as female. But she is really Shaktipat, energy, Mother Nature. You don't have a Father Nature. Everything around you here in this universe is Shakti, energy, Mother Nature, which is the active force. So they sculpture a woman dancing upon her husband's chest. That is to say, the he, the positive pole, or the proton, is at rest within its own force field. The electron is spinning around it. To convey what they really mean, that all these forces interweave themselves and act as one. Now, when we use the word he, we tend to make it personal. In reality, God is highly impersonal. He has no shape, no form. It becomes it in its true sense. It's neutral. Spirit is neutral. Spirit does not involve itself without personalities. But because we can't live without craving personality, intimacy, we have to relate with it in some form. We are humans. We are both male, female activity inside. Yin yang, positive, negative, then neutral. this part of your body. Called the male part. This part is called the female part. It's a sort of a bond between the two. And when they synchronize, we have a polarity. To make it much more intimate with us, God is music. God is not light. And if it's music, then it is harmony, melody, rhythm. The harmony is a soul. The rhythm is the soul. The melody is the soul. Now this soul breaks itself up into three parts: body, mind, and spirit. And act as an image. So the spirit is the harmony, the melody is the mind, and the rhythm is the body. So man is soul, he doesn't have a soul. Now, soul has to be fed. A certain type of nourishment. Does anyone know what that food the soul survives on?
Spiritual energy.
If music be the food of the soul, what would be the food? You will play on. Soul is only fed by music. Since we are soul, we enter the realm of divine awareness via what?
Music.
And the first symptom that you feel in your nature when you listen to music is a good trip of sensation. Now you are treated, you're lifted up, elevated. You are in contact with your divine source. It nourishes you. You play a march and your feet will start tramping. Before you know, you're ready to take on the world. You play a tango and you're ready to populate the world. Play an Irish ballad and you want to be the world's savior. You become very charitable. You play semi-classics and you want to set up the policy of the world. You play the highest classics and you want to play God. Like Bach. That's what music does to the soul. Each form of it nourishes it to act. It's strange. No marching will ever make you love anybody. Sousa's march will not make you love anybody. You'll want to march. see? And you wouldn't fight if you hear a tango. We can doubt it, but your body language will tell you that it's not possible to fight if you hear a tango. The rhythm is set up to affect only certain areas of the body, which affects the mind, which affects the spirit. So the soul has to respond. The being responds. Spirituality is simplicity. Well, how does this simplicity become such profound wisdom? That's what puzzles everybody. Where does a simple approach produce a depth of wisdom? How does it come out? Most of us expect that when we meet a spiritual person, we should have profound wisdom, total awareness of all these things. Where does he get it? Who gives it to him? Nobody gives it to him. Nobody is dishing it out like a bowl of soup out there. We're all impregnated with the wisdom of the divine nature. But we are blocked from perceiving it by complexity versus simplicity. When we become simple, then this whole complex thing begins to dissolve before our eyes. You know, when you close your eyes, what do you see? Darkness. That's complexity. The overload of the energy in the brain that prevents you from seeing the simplicity or the radiant form of the spirit. And when you are simple in action, then this darkness dissolves, it fades away, and the whole body becomes full of light. And the light is shining in the darkness. The simplicity is already glowing in this complex nature. And the darkness comprehends it. Now, complexity cannot comprehend why simplicity must grow the universe, why simplicity is our nature. Why simplicity has the answer to all things in life. Why a fungus is an antibiotic. Why, for the lack of a nail, a man lost a horseshoe. The horse threw him off and he lost his kingdom. Simplicity. The spiritual life is so simple, it borders on the ridiculous. More and more we are impressed by the divine nature of being my children. But the only difference with children and adults is that we take our responsibilities too serious. Children don't take theirs that serious. We're supposed to be responsible, we're supposed to be considerate of all things around us. And we're supposed to do our best. But we're supposed to be in an attitude of joyousness and detachment. And that's the simplicity of it. It isn't that we're not supposed to do it, we're supposed to do it. But we have to be joyous about it, we have to be cheerful about it, be of good cheer. For I have overcome the world, that is, your inner nature allows you in your simplicity, to stay in a state of inner peace and inner composure, and not get bogged down in the complexity of the outer world. It works. That's the interesting thing about it, that it works. Someone said to me, that is all good and fine philosophy, but it doesn't work in business. I said, oh, what bigger business can you have than running an ashram? Does it involve buildings and land, feeding people? You name a business. It involves transportation, equipment. People are all type of philosophies, all type of mental blocks. I'm running a hospital, an engineering corporation, all everything, paint shop and everything. You tell me which is a bigger business, but it don't work. I got more sick and healthy people coming and going, discontent and happy people. Tell me which is why it wouldn't work in business. It has to work. Where would it work? It works where we are thrown together, because that's the real test. The real test of spiritual laws is in spiritual living, in a spiritual environment. That the material environment sooner or later becomes spiritual. And a miniature form of a spiritual environment is your house. That's a miniature form, that's a model, like an image, you know. They take the ashram as the God image, and they take the household as the soul image. Man, just shifting along the size. Well, the sense of responsibility is still the same. That is a story. A man wanted to withdraw from society. Decided all he needed was two loincloth, one to wear and one to wash and wear as a spear. So the one he was wearing, he was happy, and the one he washed, he hung up. And gradually one day he had some students came around, and he saw a little field mouse nibbling away at the loincloth that he always washed as a spear. But he didn't want to kill the mouse, because thou shalt not kill, not violence. So the student said, Master, get your cap. They'll take care of the mouse. So they got the cap. Kept took care of the mouse and already took care and chased away all the birds. The cat has to eat. So he said, Master, it loves milk. Okay, do what you want. So they got him a cow. The cow gave milk, fed the cat. The cow can't stay outside of the compound because the tiger won't eat the cow. Then he come to realize that he got that much problem, he said, I'm going back to the city. I've seen so many different places where they were starting groups right here in the United States, leaving the city to go to the undeveloped land. With the wrong concept. A lot of buildings were put up, they're all crumbling and falling down. Simply because they have the wrong motive behind it. They wanted to run away from society to be in their own environment, but had no plan of consciousness or how to organize it to make it work as a conscious entity. So they're back in the city. To make an idea like that work, it takes a lot of time planning and a lot of basic training of interaction with each individual and their needs and their fears. And then you have to have common sense and a little bit of God's grace going for you. So when you hear of ashrams going up or doing things, a lot of things involved in it before it really works. So spiritual laws are best experienced where spiritual communities are, because you find out pretty soon how spiritual you are. Who can start an ashram that is not in some way aware of inner consciousness? You have to have some inner awareness. We use the word master, we have a lot of different mental connotations of meanings. Call no man master, save the Lord which is in thee. Jesus said, I of myself can do nothing, but the Father which is in me doeth everything. So any individual who started an ashram, who you think is running the ashram? Okay. But you must first find out if some other individual who God is working through a whole lot better than he says to him, you got my blessing, go do it. That's the big difference. People like to start things that they don't have the blessings of another being on a human level. And therefore, it doesn't work. When you have the blessings of someone who is in the human form, who you see is a success at doing it, then success breeds success. See, I've met a lot of people who want to start ashram simply because they think they can do it with their own ego drive. Simply because they've been trained in public relations and fundraising and getting together in social bees. It all worked that way. Without the grace, it collapses. This is one of the phenomena of an ashram. Most ashrams are founded by spiritual people who have the blessing given to them by another spiritual person who made us go of it and says, now you go, you have my blessing. Simply by stating it in consciousness, it must manifest in that other person's life. Once said, must complete itself. Spiritual person does not speak idly. Everything he says, though it may be in joke or in serious debate, carries a commitment of responsibility in his life for the other person to say it, though the other person may not be aware of it, but it's given. That's how they come to establish the term initiation, linking with the bond. When Jesus went to baptize John, he said, baptize me. And John said, no, you baptize me. And John says, you baptize me. And Jesus says, no, you baptize me. Picture for one moment two grown guys arguing about who threw a little water in each other's head. But then Jesus said to him, suffer it to be so. In other words, endure it. That this is the way of righteousness. That you perform the blessing of triggering me into action into the community. And Jesus went as far as to say, there is no man born of woman greater than John, who is Elijah that has come, pointing to John the Baptist. He is not born by the will, his own will of the flesh. He was not born by the desires of his own flesh, meaning past karma. Nor is he born by the will of his parents, the desire of his parents to have a John the Baptist. They wouldn't know what he looked like. Who would know what a John the Baptist would look like, let alone create one with mother and father? But he is born by the will of the Lord. The blessing is impounded upon John's nature to come down and act as John, who was Elijah in the last life. And he, in the humble role of a derelict, or in those days they used to call them hippies, Nazarene, but he carried on that role by that grace, that blessing. And he preached by the riverside. But when Jesus came to him, how was Jesus going to start his ashram, his group? You think he just jumped out and said, hey, look at me, I'm Jesus Christ. Let's go start our own little ashram. All of us are Essenes. We all love this thing. Don't bother with John. I'll take off and start my own group. But he was smart. He don't want to make the same mistake twice. He went to John and asked for the blessing. Then when he came to his own students, see, John even went as far as to say about Jesus, there cometh one whose shoes are not even worthy to unlatch. Each body now is exchanging blessings. That's the hidden key behind the success of saints. Why saints succeed whereas other people fail. Saints don't have no wisdom. They don't have no extra power. They don't have no extra link with God. All they have is a blessing of another person who made it. And because that blessing is committed verbally, that's how come the sense of responsibility to make it a reality in that person's life. See? If I say, go do that, no matter how ridiculous it may sound to the person listening, and how many people try to do it, only you can succeed and the rest can fail. You don't know why. And they say, well, you've got luck. Isn't that luck? It's given with the sense of carrying through to the sense of responsibility to complete it. And with all the ups and downs that you may go through, you are alone with all the rest running. Only you're going to make it because it's committed to you. See? Well, Jesus then took his own disciples and started out with his group. Then came the time when he knew he had to go away and leave his own students. They have to carry on in some way, so he picked out and asked them by giving them darshan, that is to see without the aid of working for it. He blessed them that they could see now. And he asked them, who do men say that I am? Some of them say you're a prophet, a teacher. Then all of a sudden Peter had the experience, the blessing. He said, thou art Christ. And he said to Peter, I did not tell you that. There is no way you can pin down Jesus for making such a statement. And there is a very good reason for it. The guru cannot say he's a guru. A master doesn't say he's a master. So a master never starts no ashram. It's always disciples who start ashrams. But the Father which is in you reveal it to you. The Christ principle within your own nature saw the Christ principle in my nature flowing by the grace. Now, upon this rock, now upon this experience, go out, Peter, and start your own ashram. You got my glove, you got my grace, you got my blessing, go do it now. But without that, you never make it. That's the key of why you see ashrams survive in the, around in the world. And some come and go. Devotees may come, devotees may go, but my Lord, I will be thine always. These chants all tell us a secret. Only the saint knows the secret. And the secret is grace, blessing, simplicity. There's a lot more to the spiritual life that meets the eye. And it's not hidden. It's because it's so simple that we don't realize it. In the olden days, they used to call the priest to come bless your church or bless your house, bless your store. And you hold on to your first dollar that comes in and stick it up on the wall as a good luck piece. You ever see those people go broke? I never see them go broke. I always see them thriving and the others are all in bankruptcy. There is a method to the whole thing. There is a principle behind it. The principle is blessing love. See, when a priest takes the vow, or a monk or a mystic takes the vow of non-possession, non-attachment, he turns over his petty involvement with little things to merit the blessing of being empowered to handle all of the things. And since he's empowered with this now, he has the ability imposed upon his consciousness by grace to say something and see it materialize. So if he says to you, this place is a success, you bet your bottom dollar, photo finish, it's a success. It's going to be a success right to the last second, and everybody's falling apart. Because he is committed to it by virtue of his dedication in spirit. You see? And Jesus knew when he told Peter, I'll make you a fisher of men. He knew upon this rock he will build his church, because it's committed, it's carried through. Buddhist is the same. The Buddha told his own disciples, go, raise the soul up. You think it's going to fall down? The Mohammedan, every religion that is in this world, and from them all the ashrams came out. They all succeed. The biggest business, and yet it's the biggest involvement of spirit. The biggest use of power and energy and resources. Why is it a success? Why is it surviving all these centuries? The grace, the blessing given by that person that sees it through to the end of time. So, devotees come, devotees go. But that principle is there, that blessing is there. It's a monument to spirit. That's how it works. So we cannot just go say we can open up ashrams without the grace, you know. It's like Yogananda saying to me in a letter one time, teach meditation. You think I'll teach it? Not because he told me to go teach it, I didn't teach it. I wrote him back and said, I didn't know how to teach meditation. He wrote me a second time, teach meditation. I didn't even know him more than 6 months. And he's asking me to teach meditation. And I'm struggling just to find a little peace of mind. And he's got it all, like a kid with a big bar full of Christmas pies, you know. And he's just meat, handing them out. I said I couldn't teach it. But I'll do it if I have your blessing. Whatever it is you ask me, providing I got your blessing. Because I know if you write it on a piece of paper in my mind, I'm saying, if you write it on paper, I got a book. If you say by, if you only say it, I got a book. That's for sure, no. Until that time, I ain't got no guarantee. Well, the letter came back and says, teach meditation, you got my blessings. Then I took on the responsibility of getting involved with spiritual activity. That's what you call doing the will of the Lord. See, when you do the will of the Lord, that principle embodied in the spirit of the soul of man that asks you to perform an action, and then the commitment that goes with it by grace or blessing, then you know you are performing now in this world of activity and illusion at the same time, and delusion. It's the will of the Lord that you do the thing. And he will make sure and ensure and guarantee that his will comes out on top, in spite of any other conditions that exist. So that's the whole key to the thing. You think Moses let down the people when he was in the desert? Moses gave his blessings to those, to Aaron. You think that a religious organization is going to crumble out through the time of the month? Impossible. Because Moses is committed. He don't give it, and it's going to go regardless. They come all the way through with Mohammedan, Buddhist. They all gave their consciousness. They gave it, and they are committed. That is how it works, why it works. So, the thing is that anytime you see somebody trying to start ashram, you always want to question, did they get a blessing? You don't even have to question. You will notice pretty fast if they're making it by photo finish. There are a lot of things, lots of miraculous things that happen to show you that they themselves ain't got nothing to do with it. But some other force is working behind the whole scenes. And that's just the interesting thing about it. I went one time to see a friend of mine, he's a brother disciple. And his teacher told him to go out, go and visit India. And he went to India, he came back and he started his own ashram. and he's flourishing. Because the grace. Yeah, there's another brother disciple who stays in the organization where they both studied from. But he doesn't go out. But he's a success as long as he stays in the organization. Taken away from there to go out and start his own ashram, he wouldn't make it because the grace or the blessing is not for him to act that way. And that the other one, who was told to go out and do it, he's thriving. Each disciple has got a different role, a different purpose to serve the Master or serve God. Some stay inside, some go out. That's because that's how it's set up. The blessing has a lot to do with it. Take in the case of Charan Singh and his grandfather. Before Charan Singh took over the mastership, or it was conferred upon him. Blessing. Try the best to cry. Just cry for God. And see if God is not going to answer your prayer. So she went in her room and just started crying. She had to be a pretty good actor. But she cried and cried and cried and about. She started about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody's knocking on our door. That's about 36 hours after, you know. He says, young boy, he says, the master wants you to talk to you. So she goes out, goes to the master. And that's the grandson. The sister, why are you crying? She said, who told you? He said, the Lord said that you're crying for initiation. And if I initiate you, you'll be all right. So I initiate you right now. But she threw herself at his feet and started crying out, not Charan Singh's name. Whose name she thinks she was crying out? Who she was seeing in the master in front of her? The grandfather. All through the ceremony, it was all over. When she came to her senses, she was standing at the line at the foot of the grandson. You see how God played the whole thing? And she was not delirious and not ill or anything or mentally abnormal. God merely shifted the time frame to satisfy the soul's desire. So she saw the grandfather in that particular time frame, had the initiation, and when it was all over, that is the grandson standing right there. So, in essence, we're saying that the blessing is important to do anything. Now, here is a good question, and it's written in very, very unusual English. If you're a denizen, would you like to have your venison with a benison? I'll say it again. It's a very unusual English. If you're a denizen, D-E-N-I-Z-N, would you like your venison, you know what venison is, with a benison, B-E-N-I-S-E-N? You know what the word denizen is? What it is?
Citizen.
A citizen. Would you like your venison? What is venison?
Mm-hmm.
A deer meat. With a benison. With a blessing.
Oh.
That's what the word Venice means, blessing. But that was written in one of the old scriptural texts way back in English time when they were translating to get people to be aware. Thank you.
Are you cold?
All right. Take a break.
Okay.
So I take a break and just relax it. So may come back and throw some more questions at
you. Okay. You got 1, 2, 3. Okay, show the thing. I can get a picture.
Oh.
This has 2 stamps.
So he's born an angel with a highly spiritual environment, a highly spiritual consciousness. And how does he come back to get even in America? As Mahayash Yogi, Ishwara, comes back and he sells them the American way. Make them pay for it, do it like the Masons, and tell nobody, and everybody practice it. So here we are in this 20th century. The principle comes back to us from India to America.
I always thought a lot of good coming out of that.
That was not spite. The law of karma works very effectively to balance out the desire nature. Unfulfilled desires are the causes for your reincarnation. His unfulfilled desire was to make a miracle, gravitate to transcendental meditation, Brahmanism. And he couldn't impress them. I mean, when he wrote his writings, the Americans didn't gravitate because they were not ready for it at the time. How many people got turned on to go in the woods around here in Massachusetts? Not too many. But he was ahead of his time. And that being in his consciousness, he had to bring it out in manifestation some later day when the country was ready for it. So here and everything has reached the point of all types of philosophies and so forth. He's born in the East simply to satisfy his Brahminic craving in a home of a wealthy Brahmin, exposed to the meditative precepts of the East and very American-minded, do-it-yourself attitude. So he takes all the essences of them, bring it back here. 1, put a price on it. 2, make it secret, give them the same thing. And they're all going to be on the bandwagon because it's basic psychology, and this is what the monks are all doing in the different ashrams. So don't tell nobody. He just made it like a good old American attitude. Tell all, do all, and everybody can be on the game. But just what you say, open-minded, open the door, let the hawk out. We haven't changed anything, so I'm happy to see it done. That's all. More people have been exposed to the attitude of calming their minds simply because they didn't realize that these techniques are all there. That forced now the scientists to accept it because Emerson surely wanted to make the early scientists accept the principles of mental health. And he tried to write his articles. So now today, Topeka, Kansas, and many Ganadi did it. They evolved electronic yoga, biofeedback, fancy name for transcendental meditation, which boils down to the same thing. We are all controlling our behavior from inside by right attitude, if you're consistent, which you call discipline. The discipline is repetition. That's where mantra is. The words are...
I mean, for example, if a person's not
Yes, because there is a woman who was coming out of Nazi Germany, and she was Jewish, escaping from the Nazis. The Nazis stopped the train, and her friend had told her to repeat the 93rd Psalm. And there's a verse in the 93rd Psalm, "He will cover me with his feathers, and shield and buckler." So she forgot the whole psalm, but the only part that she could remember was feathers, 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 feathers. And she sat there, mentally repeating the one word, feathers, feathers, and she looked very Teutonic when the train went by past the Nazis. Everybody was taken off that looked Jewish except her. And she arrived in Switzerland, safe, and made her way to the States. She lived there in the States, she didn't play. Now, another friend of hers lived in Houston, Texas, who was a personal friend of my wife, Margaret. That her husband used to beat her up and get drunk and come home, and she didn't know what to do, just put up with it. One day, friend told her by the same psalm, and she began to repeat the psalm, praying, and he would start to be more rational. But eventually he blew his top, came home and started beating her up, and all the groceries were knocked out of her hand, broke her teeth. And she started shouting, feathers, 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 feathers. But he got so sobered and he said, "Woman, you crazy? I don't see no chicken around here." He never drank another drink. But the mantra principle is repetition. He was cured. Now, there's another woman who cured her husband a very simple way. He beat her up. And then it was all over and she was all bruised up, you know. He was drunk. Then when he got up sober, you know, next day, breakfast. She cooked the breakfast at the table, and they had this skeleton. She sat there, "Man, you're taking this coffee. The next time you lay your hand on me, you see this hot oil? It'll be down your head when you're sound asleep, and you'll never know what burned you." And that was the last time he ever dared touch his wife with a hand. She didn't use feathers. She had a powerful thing of a mantra. She told him in outright language, "The next time you lay your hand on me, you see this hot dog, it'll be right on your head when you're sound asleep." Now that guy couldn't sleep in peace no more. He got insomnia. My wife had a hell of a time trying to cure it. So you see, we leave ourselves wide open with our own attitudes. The Simran or the mantra was one aid, but this girl was taking the bull by the horns. She didn't know, waiting for the Simran. She just told the guy off, and they became happy couples after, because there was no more interaction. She was a person and he was a person, simply that was the movie. And I have a lot of people like that I run into have this problem. Don't realize that we are learning to live with each other. We are human beings, we are not animals, and it takes a lot of growing up. Very, very difficult to grow up. Grow up from a child into adult, from an adult into a spiritual child. A spiritual child is one who sees the whole universe now from an adult level, but with a childlike attitude. The whole thing now is joy. There is no more seriousness. The seriousness is past. He's gone out of it. That doesn't say he's not responsible and has his obligations, but he is. But he takes it with a little grain of salt next time. Keeps it more cool. Don't blow his cool.
Well, Daryl, if you
walk into
a hospital and you see a man with a Christmas dying, could you prevent that Christmas from dying?
But don't you think you're imposing your own karma consciousness on that?
Right.
They didn't ask you.
Well, suppose somebody did ask.
When they ask you, that's a different story. You always say, turn it over to God. You know, tell something. In the ashram there in Thailand,
in a chapel we have a heart box. It's shaped like a heart. And I get lots of letters with people with names for healing. You know, I don't pray for them. I mail a letter to the heart box and send it to God, let him do the healing. Because I'm so stupid I can't do nothing. I'm a creation, and this person that is sick is another creation. How can the creation heal a creation? But God, the Creator, can heal. So the mailing of that letter in a physical gesture, putting it in the heart box, and getting my big ego out of the way, people are healed before the letter enters the box. I get letters after saying they're healed and so forth. Because I apply the simple technique of letting God do His work. If I can sit down and pray, oh God, heal this person, and go through all the moaning and groaning with mantras and help that person, they never get well. But because the letter comes to me and the heart box is a prayer box, I put it in there like a mailbox, and I don't question God how He's going to heal the person. I merely do the act of putting it. Now, if you write me a letter and don't mail it, will I get it? Now, as soon as you mail it, do you question the postal authorities or find out if you can deliver the letter? If I don't reply you, then that's a different story. But if you got the results from mailing it and everything, then it's gone. It's equally true. In consciousness, it works that way. If you want something for somebody, you have to release it out of consciousness and forget it. So you see how it works? So when I get letters and say, oh, Adana, you prayed for me. Adana didn't pray. All Adana took was the letter, put it in the heart box, and left it there. Let God do the job. Because if He can't do a job, I can't do it. If He didn't know that you need to get well, I don't know. I'm a physical frame. I'm just a channel. But if I get myself in the way, I'll block the channel. And the practical behavior is I like to be simple. I mail it. When I was growing up, like a child, you know, my father used to say, you want something for Santa Claus, write him a letter to the North Pole. And mail it. So literally I wrote it and I put it in the mailbox. And Santa Claus showed up Christmas time. Now, I didn't know how they got the letter out of the mailbox after they put it inside. But the present that I wanted was there around Christmas time in a big stocking. So if he can work that way, and I didn't question how the mailman got the thing, why should I question him now to find out if he can heal you through the prayer box? In other words, I'm trying to show that the simple things that you did as a child that may seem childish in a child's mind are far more effective in the adult mind, where the brain is more aware of the subtle laws of how they work. You'll get better results by acting out the gestures of a child. And I see it work, raising the dead, changing any kind of possibility thing that happens. People are calling me in terminal cases. I can't do a single thing, but I perform the action of baby things. And I don't go around hitting you in the head and let you get well. That's not my cue. I'll let the Lord do it in His own way, because that's the best way.
But what are the Psalms for?
Hmm?
What are the Psalms in the Bible for? It's just repetition.
What is a vaccination for against an epidemic? It's an insulation, it's an immunization, right?
Yeah.
Against a condition. Mantra or psalm or prayers, when repeated over and over, insulates you against the thought repercussions of others around you who wantonly use thought waves, have no respect for life, and sooner or later will bounce back and affect your life. So why get polluted by the negative discharge of other people's thought waves? Why not insulate and immunize yourself against it? You're going to adopt a smart, you don't let the disease attack your body. You've got to be smart, physician, heal yourself. So prayer unceasingly is a form of mental immunization, a form of spiritual immunization against these thought waves. You ever walk in a room and feel depressed from the thought ways of people. All right. Why are you going to immunize yourself against that? The Bible gives you a simple way. All the scriptures of the East give a simple way. Prayer unceasingly, hallowing the name of the Lord. That's what mantra yoga is. Union through repetition.
And when you want anything, just like, for example, my husband doesn't want his company to move. In other words, he just says, I don't want the company to move, I don't want the company to move, and so forth and so on. And you keep saying it, and the company won't move.
No. It's the reverse. It's the reverse.
Excuse me. I will move.
You see, God always works in reverse. This is the psychology of a God. He don't give you what you want. He give you what you need. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want it to move, he can give you exactly what you need. He can move him. I've learned his tricks a long time. So I don't interfere with his tricks. Because lesson number one in spiritual life, you eat your words back. And them verbs and adjectives are tough to swallow. I know the nouns and pronouns are not so bad. But when it comes to verbs, adjectives, and the other conjunctives, man, they're really rough to swallow. You don't say, I don't want the company to move. Because then you're wanting it, you see. Not to move. In reality, you're triggering it into a need now. Then it will need to move. See, you can't do that. But what you want is this. I love to see this buildings go up higher. I love to see this business prosper. Up. Because
here.
Right? Yeah, right. So they get the money to build it higher. Put another part on top of the building. Or buy out the guy next door. Something. But don't tell her you want it to, not to move, because you can really move it then.
Mm. It seems like the thoughts come in pairs then. I mean, whenever you wish one thing, what's in your mind is the other, and you activate.
Yeah, but you have another law in following up two together. It comes in pairs, and it always repeats itself in threes. Always. That's how it works. If you get a flat this morning, watch out, you can get two more before the week is out. If you get a bump into something, you can get two more. It not only comes in what do you call it, fear, but it repeats itself three times. It's a natural law. Because we are living in a polarity, you see, we're living in a trilogy, not a duality. The duality is the conflict, but the trilogy is the repetitiveness of it.
You mentioned this before, and I guess I wanted you to talk some more about
it. But that's how it works, you see. It always repeats itself three times to run its course. There was a woman, saint, in India, and she had lots of devotees around it. We'd attend the retreats, satsangs. And there was a woman who attended satsang and sat all the way in the back, never came up even to meet or talk to the spiritual person. And people always think, well, she was slighted, and all the rest got a little touch, handshake, a blessing or something, some little gift. Just one woman got nothing. She was so shy they talked. Then one day, the secretary finally brought her up to sit in the front. Just about that time, one of the students had brought a brand new car and wanted to show the spiritual head and would invite this woman, say, to go drive in the car. Well, the woman said to the owner of the car, would you mind if this woman join us? This is the first time she took anybody that said she took notice of this woman. And okay, no, because after all, his car is her car, and he didn't get it in the first place by his own looks. Some grace from the saint went out to get him the car, but it's a brand new car. And he wants to let the saint ride in the car. And this is a true story, because the woman is still alive and the saint is still alive and the man who was in the car is alive. So she says, let her join us. Now you sit down next to me, and they're driving. And all of a sudden, a tire blows out. You can't can imagine the face of the owner of the car, brand new car, tire blows out in the presence of the guru. Very, very disconcerting and very, very embarrassing. And especially when you're an Oriental, you're making all kind of excuses to save your face. But the saint says nothing. All right, fix the car, we wait. Put on the spare tire, drive along, look in the countryside, power goes out another tire. Well, here is the problem. The spare tire has got a hole, and a new one has got a hole. He really got upset. The guy is in tears already. But strange as it may be, where the tire blew out was right next to where they were getting petrol, because, you know, in those places don't call it gasoline, they call it petrol. It's a petrol place. And the man came out with a light and he gave them some petrol, and then he took the tire and patched the tire and put it back on. And they got in the car and they were going along. Right in the middle of the night, heading back to the ashram, pow! Blows out the third tire. Then he has to go back to the spare because they have to patch. So you can imagine this guy really shook up. Never again he's ever gonna invite a saint to ride his car. So he's making all the excuses. But the saint says, "Don't cry, my son. This little woman has saved you a lot of karma. By your tires blowing out, you might have been dead. And her life also. But because your car was used the night to shunt the karma between you and the woman, the saint didn't tell them their connection to get in past life. The car was used to get rid of both of your karma." Now, three blowouts. How many people are in the car? He wanted the car to show off to who? But this woman was way in the background out of a whole bunch of people. Nobody ever paid attention to her all the years that she came to this satsang. And this one day, she decides he's going to bring her, put her in front, to sit down in front of the teacher. So she sits down in front and say nothing. Out of his compassion for the woman, he brings her to sit down in front of the teacher, and at the same time he got a brand new car. You see subtle connections. Then when the teacher says, "You mind if I ask her to drive with us in the car?" So all three of them in the car. So the teacher worked out their karma by blowing out the tires. Was better the tires blow out than their life be taken in some accident that they had a karmic debt. Yes. You'll go home and come back tomorrow morning. What time? 5 o'clock meditation?
5:30.
5:30, okay. Well, that's where it ends. Thus saith the Lord. Come back tomorrow morning, 5:30.